Gorgeous Entertainment on Radio Gorgeous.
Today on Radio Gorgeous, I'm really excited to be interviewing the double platinum, Brit-nominated singer-songwriter, hailed by Q Magazine as the heir to Dusty Springfield and Karen Carpenter, the amazing Rumour. Hi, Rumour. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Karina.
Oh, it's a pleasure, an absolute pleasure. So, Rumour, you're most well-known as a highly successful singer, but a few years ago you became really actively involved in animal welfare, particularly dogs. What issues are you involved in campaigning about and why?
Well, I got my dog Alfie from a rescue in, I think, 2013, and it basically just changed my life. You know, Alfie changed my life, my relationship with him changed my life, and he just stole my heart. After that, I just became so sensitive to all these issues. And, you know, previously to getting Alfie, you know, I had a difficult time adjusting to the whole being in the record industry type thing, and I felt like I was sort of, I went through a dehumanization process in terms of like being a marketed product. Mm. And so I had this really strong sense of understanding what it was like not to be exploited by humans. Mm-hmm. Because I felt like I was more on the other side of exploitation as like the product, yep. You know, in a company. And so I think my compassion for animals and not just animals, but, you know, all like whole of nature and the land and everything was heightened, mm. You know, throughout that process, which I found really, really difficult. And then after that, I got Alfie and just became really into it. I mean, what disturbs me, I mean, there's just so many things to do. There's so much to do. And I'm not saying that I'm, you know, really advanced in that area. I'm really just a person who's interested in starting out, mm. Trying to take an interest in a concerned citizen, really, but interested in what's going on in terms of animal torture in Asia, in China, in Korea, and Indonesia, places like that, where, you know, the dog meat trade is, you know, when you learn about it, is absolutely horrendous.
Oh, it's appalling.
Mm. And then, you know, all sorts of things, you know, then we have domestic issues like puppy farming. Mm. That what really bothers me is the Beagle breeding facility in Grimston, mm. That was given permission to go ahead by the government after, well, previous government had not approved it. And that just chills me to the core, mm. that we have a Beagle breeding facility there that's farming out dogs to probably other parts of the world, mm. where animal rights, you know, they mm. don't share mm. Our welfare standards. And, you know, if you look at Grimston on the map, it's quite far away from mm. anywhere. It's in the middle of nowhere. That really upsets me, that the Grimston breeding facility.
I mean, as you know, I'm a passionate advocate of adopt, don't shop.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I know you've adopted your gorgeous Alfie, and I've met him. He's absolutely adorable. For our listeners, can you describe what Alfie's like and the difference he's made to your life?
Well, firstly, Alfie is extremely handsome. He always gets compliments wherever he goes. And people always say, that dog's got a beard. and he looks like an old man. He absolutely is wonderful. He loves the pub. He's really multidimensional. He's extremely smart. He's highly intelligent. I mean, so many people look at Alfie and go, what kind of dog is that? What breed is that? And I think, well, no, he's not a breed. I think he might be maybe half collie, half something. But people always remark on what a great dog Alfie mm. is, while their dog's sort of bouncing off the walls, you mm. know, their dog that they probably paid £800 mm. for. And I'm thinking, well, you know, please do consider getting a rescue, because they're wonderful dogs. And there's just, you know, I don't know, I live in America, and rescue is actually a lot more prevalent there. Mm. I noticed that after I got Alfie and I was living in England again for a little while, noticing that we are quite breed, mm. we're still quite breed focused. Mm. That might be because we're hunting, we're still that sort of, that's that hunting mm. nation, and, you know, there are lots of interest in breeding, and
yeah,
and I understand that from a cultural point mm. of view, but like you say, these designer dogs and all the rest of it really is not necessary, because mm. there's a dog for everybody.
Yeah. That's absolutely right. Can you talk about a little bit how you found Alfie?
Well, I mean, I really am so, every time I think about this, I think, oh, I'm so fortunate, I'm so lucky that, it was just, I hit the jackpot with Alfie. There was a little shelter in the town that I was living in, Arkansas, and it was off this little slip road, and the only way you could get there is if you were in the right-hand lane. You'd have to get in your right lane and, mm-hmm. and turn right at the lights. And I was just at the lights one day, and I said to Rob, "Turn right!" And he said, "No!" And I said, "Yes!" And he knew at that moment that it was done, like it was over. And he just went, "Oh," turn the steering wheel. And I don't know, something in me just said, "Turn right." We went into the shelter. You know, he was a really cute dog. So I didn't want to take him out first because I wanted to maybe like give some of the ugly ones a chance. Mm. So actually we took a few of the, more funny looking ones. I don't know. We took some of the more unfortunate looking ones out, but then we took Alfie out, and Alfie was just so obedient, and he was just an extraordinary dog. And that was it. That was love. I was so excited about getting him the next day. And after that, he became the love of my life.
Oh, that's lovely, Rumour. Yeah. He's absolutely gorgeous, adorable.
And you know what, he did a lot for me. I mean, he took me out, you know, because when you have a dog, you tend to go out a lot more.
Yes.
You tend to walk and go, you know, to lovely places of natural beauty. Mm. And it's just more fun. It's just more fun with them because they enjoy it, and then you enjoy it through them.
Mm. And you meet like-minded souls, don't you? So you meet other dog walkers who are from a similar kind of viewpoint.
Yeah,
absolutely. I love that about dogs. Yeah. So picking up on America, you've been there for a few years now, aren't you? But you're back in the UK to do some gigs.
Yes.
How did that come about?
You know, just got asked to do a couple of things, and I thought I should. I'd been away for a little while, you know, had a baby in 2017, in March 2017, and had just been sort of in that sort of domestic place with the whole, you know, adjusting to the baby life, and really needed to kind of like come here and show my face a little bit and do some work.
And just touching there on your lovely little son Denny, isn't it?
Yeah.
How's that changed your life?
It's absolutely huge. I mean, it really is. I had no idea, because you think, oh, well, everybody does it. You know, people do it every you know, there's one born every minute. But it is absolutely huge thing to take on. And it's just a lot.
Mm.
It's just a lot. It's a lot of love. It's a lot of happiness. But it's also a lot of laundry. It's a lot of washing up. It's a lot of anxiety, you know. It's just a lot of everything.
Yeah.
Suddenly, there's just a lot more of everything.
Yeah.
A lot more life. It's just wonderful, and he's an amazing little boy, and I'm very, very fortunate. It's just that it's just been an adjustment in terms of like trying to find new processes on how to work, and also I lost my confidence. I've really lost my confidence in myself, and I think that happens to people when they have a baby. I don't know. I've heard that happens to people when they have a baby.
Yeah.
You just sort of think, oh, can I do my work the same way, because your brain sort of shifts and changes and you change and your body changes. And also it's what's quite interesting about having a baby, physically having a baby, is that just how your body completely changes and putting on a lot of weight in a very short space of time and then not being able to fit into anything just makes you feel awful and it doesn't help your confidence. You know, you can't be as curious in the way that you were before, because my curiosity led me to some very strange and interesting places before. And I was always curious and interested to go there, you know, even if it was like, maybe this is not a good idea. But now, you can't do things like that.
Right.
You can't sort of say, oh, what an interesting person. I might strike up a conversation with this person because they seem interesting. Well, now I'm more like that guy, or that person seems weird.
It's the mothering protective instinct, I guess, coming in, isn't it?
And also it changes your feelings about work. You know, I have to travel a lot for work, so it changes your feelings about that. It's a lot of things, really.
Do you think it will change the way you write songs and what you write about?
I think so, but I think it always you know, you always write about things that you're going through. I think I feel more rusty, actually, truthfully, than I have before. I don't know, it's because when I was 22, 23, I was a bit more, you're in a different space.
Yeah.
Or you're in your early 20s and, you know, you're quite happy to put your guitar on your back. And
well, you think you're unstoppable, don't you, as well?
Yeah, you've got a lot more energy.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a different thing. I think the work that I did when I was in my 20s is really, really valid and I'm really proud of it. But I can reproduce it the same because I'm not the same person, you know.
Are you writing at the moment?
Yeah, I'm trying to get my sort of mojo back with that. It's just about finding the space to do that.
So how are you approaching the concerts? You've got a big one coming up, haven't you, with Gary Barlow this weekend?
Yes, on Sunday. I'm about to go to rehearsal. Yeah, you know, I get nervous. I get nervous about performing. But, do you know, I read something really interesting the other day, which was, did you know, you probably know this, I'm probably telling people things they already know, but I found out that when you cry, emotional tears, it can actually contains compounds, hormones, or some sort of compound that actually adjusts your neurotransmitters in the brain. So when you, like you say you had a good cry and you feel better, it actually does adjust your brain chemistry. And interestingly, when you chop an onion or something like that, it doesn't contain those hormones.
Ah.
So emotional tears adjust your neurotransmitters in the brain. So I thought to myself, you know, I sometimes think, oh, why do people want to come and see me sing? Because I'm not really, you know, it's not really a dancing type thing. It's not really jolly in that way. And I think, well, maybe sometimes I could help people to like connect with their emotions and have a cry or something like that. And you know what? That is actually really a powerful thing. And when I read about that, I thought to myself, Karina, everybody needs to cry.
They do. You're absolutely
as
right.
As much as possible, if they need to. Because it's almost like the sort of thermostat. That's there for a reason. So trying to repress our emotions so really actually, it's not just bad in theory, like just some idea, it's not actually bad for you physically.
Yes, it kind of resets you then, doesn't it?
Yeah. It actually can cause you to become ill if you don't cry. So I find that really interesting. I think I would study neuroscience if I wasn't doing singing.
Ah, maybe you could do that on the side.
Yeah, well, I've done about that. I have another lifetime. But I really find it interesting, like how it all... You know, how brain chemistry and mental illness, and, you know, how people struggle with imbalances in their brains and how we really don't understand a lot about how the brains work and how we can help. But it just made me realise, you know, when you connect to your emotions and if you express your emotions and if you cry and if you can do that, the health benefits are enormous.
So you'll be handing out tissues at your concerts then?
Well, I'm not sure if I'm going to make anyone cry. But it made me put a couple of more... When I read that, I thought, I'm going to put those other songs that I don't normally do in back in the set, the ones, the sad ones. But I thought, oh, no one wants to hear those sad ones. Well, I put them back in.
But I think there's definitely something about that, because I know I'm just looking across now at my own CD collection and thinking about, you know, what I've got on Spotify. There's certain songs I'll listen to when I'm in a certain mood. So if I'm in a certain mood and I want to feel emotional and I want to think about things, I'll put on a piece of music that I wouldn't put on at another time. So I think that's absolutely right.
You know, so many people like Adele, you know, she makes people cry. That helps them.
Yeah.
You know, it helps them to, you know, express themselves. So it's a really important thing.
Yeah. When I was at university, my friends always used to laugh because I used to really, it was very unfashionable then to listen to Karen Carpenter. And when I was down for whatever reason, I'd put Karen Carpenter on because I used to think, well, no one can sound as sad as her. And it actually cheered me up. So it had kind of like a
it's
reverse
like watching
effect.
EastEnders, isn't
it? But I was very untrendy, but I was happy. So
well, you didn't know how cool you were at the time.
Yeah, she's back in fashion. She certainly is now. Yeah. And going back to that about mental health, you've been very open about some of your struggles you've had with that.
Absolutely.
After your first album.
Do you know, I was embarrassed about it, but go on, sorry.
Yeah, no. I don't know if you were here in the UK. It's really opened up, actually. It was just fantastic. More people are talking about it. The royal family are talking about it. And I just wondered what the situation was in America, if it was the same.
Do you know, I think they medicate a lot more in America. I don't really know, because I'm not from America and I don't really feel American. I sort of enjoy it being there and I lightly engage with the culture, but I don't really feel like I'm a citizen of that country.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but I am pleased to hear that more people are talking about it. Certainly when I was talking about it, it really was not a sexy subject at all. In fact, I found myself stigmatized by it.
Right.
And actually, I had a lot of bad negative reaction in my business from that.
That's
talking
awful.
About it. Yeah, no, I did. I actually directly had problems from that. You know, because people say it's a very male-dominated macho business, and they say, oh, is Rima, you know, okay in the head? You know, it's like, how is she? It's something like that, you know, so they won't give you a job or they won't put you on order or something because they think, oh, you must be a bit mental, you know. You know, because with women, it's very easy to portray you as crazy. Mm. She's crazy. There's nothing a man doesn't like more than a crazy woman. But the truth is, this has got nothing to do with being crazy. This is all about neurochemistry, if that's even a word. And also, we don't really have the language to articulate emotions. So we don't have an emotional dictionary, and we don't teach children, well, let's talk about, you know, what all these things are, like what's happening.
Yeah.
Let's give it some language. Let's give it some context. Like, you know, I think they should definitely have more in personal social education, more emotional competence.
I think it's happening more now in schools. We have here now, we have Mental Health Awareness Week. And I think actually the fact calling it mental health actually helps, because it's talking about the issues you're talking about. It's actually, you know, it's a physical thing that's happening to you that's associated with your health.
Absolutely.
So I think that will help, but I think there's still a long way to go, but it's getting better.
Well, young people I'm worried about because of all the internet stuff and the shaming.
Yeah.
You know, how young women are, especially, are made to feel ashamed.
Yeah.
Just really from the start of puberty onwards, they're just made to feel ashamed of themselves. Made to feel ashamed about periods, made to feel ashamed about sex, made to feel ashamed about everything, and not being pretty enough, and not having the right clothes, and not having the right hair, and not having the right this. And I just can't even imagine being a young person now. I just think the minutiae of all
it's
that
so much pressure
would just, it would make me so upset.
I wanted to talk to you about, actually there's a really good link up there about Time's Up and Me Too, because it's very much in the UK kind of coming from the States here. We're getting a lot of it here and it's been a big momentum here. I wanted to talk to you a little about what you've experienced with that in the music industry.
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of it on the peripheries. I mean, actually what I've discovered from being in the actual music business, so like in a major label, I've never experienced it with any member of staff in the major label that I was with.
Good.
I never experienced that. I experienced sexism, but I didn't experience that kind of thing. You know, I've been doing it for a long time, I was 18. You sort of get to used to being sort of casually patronised and having to fight to have your ideas listened to and to be taken seriously and to, you know you're always battling against someone saying, well, you didn't really do that or you didn't really write that. I'd say, well, you know, make a comment, like a technical comment, and they would say, oh, you've got good ears, or you tune that guitar yourself, or you know, just stuff like that.
And it's patronizing,
just very patronizing. And it's something that actually you just grow to, you learn to adapt to, because you very quickly realize I can't react to every single thing because it's so many, it's so endemic, it's so part of this, like, you know. But in terms of, like, I've never been a classically pretty girl. Ultimately, I think sort of being sort of not so pretty and a little bit chubby actually just served me quite well. I just didn't really, you know, I wasn't really a target for that kind of thing. But I know it goes on, and I know people, I know it's happened to people, and I know people that it's happened to. But I also know that the music industry, it doesn't like criticism, and they will shun.
You don't think that will change?
Not in this. I don't think so. This business,
because it looks like it kind of changes, doesn't it, with the film industry, but the music industry is a little bit perhaps behind.
I mean, like I said, I never saw any bad behaviour within the actual business. I think the actual record companies are quite respectable. I think what the problem is the murky edges where they're not professionals. They are, you know, wannabes, you know, people trying to help the girls, trying to get their thing going,
right,
trying to get their demos made. So that's why the industry are like, well, we're not doing anything. I think to a certain extent they're right, because they're actually not.
Okay, yeah. So it's on the edges.
It's on the edges. It's the murky waters around, trying to get in the business, because it's very hard to get into the business.
Yeah.
And people take advantage of you trying to get into the business.
I bet, I can imagine. But someone who's been in the business a very long time is Lamont Dozier.
Yes.
And I know you've just done a duet with him. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, you know, I was just asked to do a song for his record with quite a few other people, which is really, really nice. And he's lovely. He sent me a lovely letter afterwards.
So he's done all the Motown stuff, hasn't he? So he's written Baby Love.
Yeah.
All of those tracks that the Supremes were famous for.
Amazing body
of work. You Can't Hurry Love.
Yeah, amazing body of work. So, no, I think it's a really nice record that Fred Marlin did in Nashville. So, yeah, it's a really nice...
So it's You Keep Me Hanging On, that's right, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah, yeah, I've listened to it. It's absolutely fantastic.
Oh, it's,
yeah,
just, it's a little, lovely. Just a little thing.
Yeah, his album is great, actually.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking about, obviously, one of your biggest hits was Slow.
Yes.
And I was wondering, if you did a duet, who would you like to do a duet with on that?
On Slow?
Yeah.
I'm just thinking of the voice who would be good. God, who would be good? What do you think?
Oh, I'm not sure.
Duet. I'd have to have a think about that.
Yeah, it would be a complimentary.
I remember when I did Daryl Hall, Daryl's house, and he sang Take Me As I Am with To Me, and he did a verse, and I was melting.
Wow.
And he sang Sarah Smile to Me, and I was like crying because he was so good. Because he is so, so amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, I had no idea, because it wasn't like I was a huge Hall & Oates fan growing up, because it wasn't my era.
Mm.
I wasn't, you know, coming from a super fan kind of place. But when you walk into the room with someone with so much presence and so much talent, and you just, they have this energy about them, oh my God. So I just think, now, who would be good at that? It'd have to be someone kind of dreamy. Maybe Elvis, Back from the Dead.
Yeah, it could be someone Back from the Dead. Yeah, I like that. We're and Elvis.
Yeah.
Both one-word names.
Maybe I could do it with an Elvis impersonator.
Yeah. Well, they're bringing ABBA, aren't they, back as an avatar. So you could be with Elvis avatar.
Now, that would be cool.
Yeah, there's an idea.
Because he would do that. You make me want to sing about love. I think he would smash it.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that idea. And finally, what I also loved was one of your recent tweets. I'm going to read this out. This is just absolutely brilliant. When I get home, I'm going to get a newspaper and sit in a half-empty old man's pub with a dartboard that doesn't serve any food except crisps.
Yeah, that's to me, that's culture. That's our culture.
I just love that.
That's what I'm missing. You see, I'm missing our culture.
Mm.
I hate to say it, but. That's kind of what we are.
So you're going to make sure you do that on this trip?
I'd like to, but the thing is, it's so hard not to find a foodie pub.
Yeah.
No, I grew up in pubs because my mum sort of married a heavy drinker. So I became like a pub kid, you know, and, you know, on the fruit machines and the packet of crisps and a Coke kind of thing. So I always love pubs and pub culture.
Yeah. Because you don't get that in America, do you?
Do you know what? It's so funny. When you're in England, you think, we don't have any culture. You know, you go to Spain and Italy and you think, oh, they've got so much culture. They've got paella and the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And what have we got? And then you go to America and you realise, oh my God, we're so interesting. Like, compared to Americans, we have the pub. Like, and of course, obviously Ireland as well, but this pub culture is very unique. It's a wonderful thing, and I think we've got so many wonderful cultures, actually, and we should celebrate them more. And you know what? One thing I want to say about America and England, the biggest difference I found is in the medical system. Because of the NHS, people actually do care about you. They actually go, oh, what's wrong, and let's try and fix it kind of thing, and they're interested, you know. But in America, they're not interested in they're actually just, they're just there to kind of, like, do, it's a business.
Yeah.
So, and which is really fascinating when you come from a country that does care. And I really want us to continue to care. I know it's changed and, you know, the things have changed recently. Yeah. But we should be proud of that, and we shouldn't lose that.
Do you try and keep a bit of England back with you in the States? Do you, like, have a tin of baked beans in the cupboard? And
well, I actually live in an area where there's quite a few English people, because I live in the area of northwest Arkansas that Walmart is based in.
Okay.
And Walmart recently bought Asda. Well, a few years ago, bought Asda. So there's a lot of Asda people who live in Arkansas. So funnily enough, there's actually a whole, I think it's hundreds and hundreds of people from Yorkshire in Arkansas.
Wow.
Randomly. So you always meet Yorkshire people in Arkansas. But there's a shop that sells, like, Weetabix and things like that. And we're always like, who bought all the Weetabix? You know, we're always like, who went in there? We know who it is. Someone's going in there buying, bulk buying.
Yeah.
And it's really frowned upon. Like, someone's bulk buying. So it's the bulk. There's Weetabix we can get, baked beans we can get, tomato soup. We have to go to Tulsa. You have to drive 2 hours to get tomato soup, Heinz
to
tomato
Tulsa.
Soup. Yeah.
So 48 hours to Tulsa.
Yeah. To the world market.
What do you miss the most? What's the one thing you miss the most?
Just overall food quality is like 50% less there.
Oh, right.
Because this is, they're using too many pesticides and food doesn't taste as good.
Right.
They overuse pesticides. Yeah. Everything just feels a little bit more carcinogenic in America. Mm. There's less regulation. It's really all about money.
Yeah.
They're very money, you know, money is God. I hate to say it, but, you know, so money is put above everything and people's health and people's, you know, well-being. So that made me realise just how much we had to be proud of here.
Yeah.
You know, because we go to holiday in America, you don't really notice because we speak the same language.
Yes.
We can share a lot of cultural things. Mm. We watch a lot of movies.
Yeah.
We think, oh, we're quite similar. But when you live there, you realise, no, we're different. And we're actually more caring in terms of, like, our society as a society. I'm not saying saying individual Americans aren't caring because they very much are.
Yeah.
But I'm saying as a society, we care more, you know, about the whole.
Yeah. Well, I hope you enjoy your time back here, Rim, and you find some tomato soup.
Thank
in
you.
A pub with crisps.
Oh, God, I know. Thank you.
It's been so, so lovely to see you again. Good luck with the concerts. Thank you so much for coming to speak to me on Radio Gorgeous.
It was very nice speaking to you. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, Rima. For more amazing interviews with amazing women, please visit radiogorgeous.com.
Radiogorgeous.com.